Okay, today I would like to talk about the continuation of some work that actually was very influenced by the last meeting here in 2012, I think in December, if I remember correctly, that where we actually did a revision for a paper and I should say really benefited from a lot of discussion, especially with Rob and Ken and Phil Hotchkey and Susan here and lots of other people. And I think it's really, I think we can count ourselves lucky to have these kind of meetings. I think it's, at least for our work, it's been really instrumental. The work I'm talking about is mainly done by Micha, who's not here anymore, but in Cancun. And the experiments are largely done by Veit Buchholz. Patricia Graef has contributed some work, and more recently other people who work in the Busch Lab at the Technical University of Munich, with whom all this work is done in collaboration. And there's various, I'm not going to get various funding sources. So I'll speak about a problem that I think many people have worked on, and just to say a little bit of the background, of course, in this audience, everyone knows CD8 T cells in an acute immune response, say to a virus, for example, differentiate into what's known as effector cells. And these effector cells dominate the acute response. And later on, we see that what is left after the acute response are various types of memory T cells, which are more numerous than the starting naive T cells. So that would be typically clone size, not maybe in the sense of an antigen receptor sequence, but rather of a specificity here, as I think Paul has also shown in his slides. And these are sort of kind of typical numbers during a strong acute response, say, to listeria, which is a bacterium, but also to many viruses, RCV, for example. The distinction between effector cell types and memory cell types has been made now for quite some time. I think Antonio Lanzavecchia was very instrumental in also subdividing these further, but many other people have contributed. And the simplest model that has been proposed and that I think is well known and finds itself in hundreds of papers and even more, is a model that simply follows the sequence that effector T cells that dominate the primary response then give rise to memory T cells that are seen afterwards. So it would be a model that would look something like this. Antigen leads to a specific expansion of specific clones. Most of the cells die off, and some of the cells become memory. And there is a lot of truth in that, namely in the sense that during the acute response, practically all of the cells, at least when we have a very strong antigen, all of the cells show effector properties. So in some sense, the cells that you do see in the primary response are effector cells, okay, to varying degrees. And so in this sense, the model is certainly absolutely correct. But in a cell biological sense, it has an interesting implication that I always found was a very strong statement to make, because it would say that you develop from a naive T cell that is relatively long-lived into a sort of a short-lived effector response. From this, you derive again cells that are not as long-lived as the naive cells, but carry memory and are quiescent again, and then they become effector cells again. So you get this kind of cyclical patterns of, I would say, cell fate or cell differentiation. Just a little bit by way of introduction, of course, through the work of many people who are here, Yosei isn't here, but Rob, Becca, and many others, and really in multiple papers, there's a large and very interesting literature. I shouldn't forget Alan, who has also contributed very much to this, to the ideas that underlie this work. We have good ideas now by the lifetimes of these cells. Actually, I think, Rob, you've seen this on the wiki. There was the request for, after I gave the talk, for listing some of the most important papers. And I've also found it quite difficult, knowing Dr. Literature well, because there's really multiple papers with somewhat different estimates. So maybe it would be great to get your take on this. But it's the pattern that's been emerging is the same for humans and mice, although on different timescales. Naive cells are comparatively long-lived. Effector cells are relatively short-lived. There's memory cell measurements in the mouse that are very accurate, that show actually surprisingly short-lived in some sense on an intermediate time scale. If I understand the measurements correctly, these are done either on bulk memory or on what is called effector memory cells, which effectively is the same thing, I think, because the memory is dominated by effector memory cells, while we will see there's another cell type, which I think deserves to be studied very carefully, and these are central memory cells. And Rob, please step in if you know something. I have not been able to find very good lifetime measurements for these cells.
Sorry to interrupt you, Thomas. Are you just defining memory by CD62L1 or something? So, like, here we have these estimates. How
would you normally find? Right. So, the traditional way of looking at these cells is CD62L high, CD127 high, CD27 high cells that emerge in the wake of the immune response. But of course, I fully agree. I mean, markers are only as useful as they hit something. But I think that there is, I'll show you some evidence that these cells have functionally some specific properties that the other cell types don't have. Okay. So the markers do enrich for something.
I both ask a similar question. What about the effectors here? I mean,
in this.
Do you mean, I'm always being a bit confused about this, between the difference between effector memory and effector, a cell actually that is killing is to me an effector, right?
Right.
While it's killing, it's killing.
Right. So. I have to say, I mean, there is a vast literature, and it's easy to offend people who have particular views in this field.
Right.
I would say what we see as effector memory are effector cells that live a lot bit longer than we usually see them during the actual acute response. And if you look at CMV responders, for example, what Rob talked about, I think these inflationary responses are mainly, if I'm informed correctly, carried by effector memory cells, which, to my mind, serve as something like an antibody titer, but it's sort of a T-cell titer that continuously keeps the virus in check. So I think that what really distinguishes them, except for some markers, are we will also see that they fit into a sequence of events very nicely. So I would say there is some justification for these cells. But in some sense, they're like effector cells, but they live longer.
So this 15-day lifespan in mice is just done by taking spleen from mice and sorting for CD44 high cells.
Right.
So you really don't know, it's the cells with a memory phenotype. And since we know it includes infected cells, they are called effector memory.
Exactly.
But mice are not undergoing immune responses at all.
I see.
Do they have Gram zyme and all those? I mean, are they poised to kill?
No, probably not.
Right. Because those hard cells are hard to catch, right? Those real effectors, at least.
Yeah. And it's indeed a bit surprising, because I think Rafi Ahmed has the nicest data on this day. Immunized mice with LCMV, CFSC labeled the memory cells, and then followed for a year the dilution of CFSC in these memory cells.
Right.
And then you know you have antigen-specific memory cells because they sort for them, and they have this beautiful Poisson-like dilution of the CFSC, and they estimate a 50-day lifespan. So the overall memory phenotype population in mouse is shorter lived than the true antigen-specific memory cells. Is my take on it. And I don't know exactly what to make of this.
Isn't 50 days between divisions necessarily?
Yeah. Because in the division time, the population stays stable, so it should be a sort of turnover.
Right. There's one point I would like to point out. That's not a strong opinion of mine, but we usually look in the blood and the lymphoid organs. But there are, of course, people who think that there are effective memory cells somewhere else in the body, and in particular in the bone marrow. It's well shown by Andreas Radbruch for CD4 cells. And the bone marrow may particularly be a niche where cells may live very long, as we may think about. I think as the current evidence for the plasma cells would point to that they're actually long-lived plasma cells in the bone marrow, although I think fully conclusive proof is still absent. Okay, there's molecular features of these cells, and I'm just showing this here. This is from, we discussed a lot of CyTOF data, it's one of the earliest CyTOF papers. This is just human blood, also no particular infection. And a site of a three-dimensional PCA, and it's placing these sort of traditional cell types here, central memory, effector memory, naive, and this short-lived effector cells down here, according to multi-dimensional markers of everything, about 30 markers here, and you can sort of form your own opinion about it. It's a little bit rotated. Okay, so because talks tend to be rich of questions, I thought I'll start with a summary, and then I'll give you the evidence for it that we have, and I'm happy to discuss any point in any detail. So what we think is really going on is not something like this, but it's something like that. And we are not the only ones to think about thinking this way, but I will tell you our type of evidence that led us to this picture, okay? And
can I ask a dumb question about the PC?
This one, yeah?
So what are the components here? I mean, what are the combination of markers?
So I have to say we need to go back to the paper. I think what they did is they labeled with lymphocyte, a cocktail of lymphocyte-relevant surface markers, and I'm not even sure that it involves intracellular staining. I think it's, we have to go back. I cannot answer your question at the moment. But I think most of it are typical surface markers of lymphocytes.
But I was curious, this is principal components, right?
Right, yeah.
I was just curious, what turned out to be the most important?
The most important one, yes, yeah. Yes. I'm sure one can get back into this. Okay. I mean, I have to say I haven't studied this so carefully. We just liked it, so I'll see in a second why. So what we think is going on is the following. Let's focus on the first line here. So what happens during first response is the following. And I think the main point of what I'm trying to say is that we think that already during the acute response, there is a distinction between cells that will become memory, although they do have effector properties, okay, and cells that will just carry the effector response and mainly die off afterwards. Some of them survive. And the cells that mainly survive are effector memory cells. So they also count as memory. So I put two different cell types here. Some would be short-lived effector cells, let's say the dark blue. The other ones would be these effector memory cells. They live longer, but they have no capacity to re-expand upon secondary challenge. They're just there as cells. Okay? Effector memory is also the main phenotype of cells you see in tumor infiltrates. And again, they have. If you try to re-expand them, that's very hard. By something.
So why do you call them memory cell then?
This one here?
No, the effector, what you're calling effector memory, they can't re-expand.
That's people call them memory cells.
That seems strange.
In all our analysis, these cells are much closer to effector cells than they are to the true memory cells, I would say. And I'll show some examples. So in the phenotypic analysis, they would gather together with the effector cells, and also in some molecular analysis, they're actually closer to effector cells. Okay. So these precursors here, I should really point out, they do have effector properties. They, for example, in our hands, are very good interferon producers. Okay, which is typical effector property. We think that from these central memory precursors, after the immune response, where most of these cells have died off, or the effector memory cells have lived on, real memory cells are derived. And then the secondary response really derives again from these central memory cells into this sort of activated central memory stage, where they also proliferate, gives rise again to these effector compartments where some cells are short-lived, other cells are longer-lived, like effector memory cells. We also find, and I'll show you evidence for this, that antigen is really regulating this population tightly, and this is proliferating rather slowly. Then this population in particular of antigen becomes limiting. So this is a population that is not very prevalent during the acute response simply because it doesn't expand as much. And we also have some evidence that antigen, the proliferation of this population is largely independent of antigen, of the antigen stimulus. So we see both, it has been discussed for a long time what antigen is doing. We see both effects. We see antigen-dependent parts, and we see antigen-independent parts in this.
Roughly, what are you getting for division times for slow and fast?
In terms of division rate, the difference is not very large, it's 1.5, and the division times are on the order of, say, between 10 and 20 hours in our data. This question is whether we catch all the cells, maybe it's just but it's exponential, so in this range. but they are more on the 20-hour side than on the 10-hour side, but it's 50%. This is 100%, it's 150, so it's not so much.
I don't understand why you keep hold of effective memory cells. So it's about 30% of CD8 cells in the absence of any
Why we keep the term, or why the body keeps them?
Why we keep them.
Why the body keeps them.
Yeah, so here they've only got a role.
I don't know.
But yeah. they must re-expand, right?
They don't. Not in our assays. So
the infection, they're what, 30%, 40% of CD8 cells?
Yeah. Their re-expansion capacity in for the data that I know is practically non-existent. Maybe they re-expand a little bit, but they don't. They cannot carry a secondary immune response.
Would you pull those in with the tissue resident effect numbers then?
Probably, yeah.
So then they can respond within minutes of an
exactly,
infection.
Exactly. Yeah.
So they are responsive. They just don't.
They're absolutely responsive. So, like in CMV again, maybe this is what protects you from the virus in a sort of level fashion.
But you say they're short lived. So indeed,
this is interesting. You say they're short lived.
Yeah. So indeed, why do you still find them after?
So what I'm saying is not that they don't divide. We haven't studied this very carefully, but I'll show you an experiment later where you do an adoptive transfer of very few cells, and you ask whether they can sustain a full-blown immune response, and effector memory cells can't, while central memory cells can. That's the difference that I'm meaning. So these cells, I'm sure they can still divide. I mean, I'm not saying they're non-dividing, but we don't have. Maybe there's better data than I have in my head now, but if you stimulate them, you cannot regenerate a full-blown response from them, while you can from these cells. So they have massive proliferation capacity and proliferate rather slowly, while they have practically a very limited proliferation capacity. So maybe that's probably, I would expect, what's going on. So these cells are rather a little bit like tissue stem cells. They don't do so much themselves, but in fact they can sustain responses. And there's two features in this scheme here that I want to point out first, and then I would like to look in the first part of my talk, and then I will look at this part in the second part of my talk as far as I get. The first feature is, if this is true, these cells have to be multipotent, so they have to generate several types of progeny. And in some sense, they have to self-renew. They must not be wasted during these types of immune responses. So there must be also proliferation in this compartment. Okay. So this is a slide shown often, but it's highlighting the problem if you do adoptive transfer. It's a great tool, and we just talked with Benny yesterday, and apparently it was Ave Mitchison who first really did this on a large scale and really invented it. And it has been done over and over again for these systems, but it's important to keep in mind this is just a sort of a sample where you get the same outcome on this upper and the lower mechanism here, but the underlying dynamics are entirely different. Here it's a very selective, it's a rare differentiation event with a massive proliferative advantage, while here things are really balanced. And the main thing to keep in mind is that if you do these adoptive transfers, you can to some extent use them to estimate parameters if you do time course experiments and you have an underlying model that you believe in, so that's good. But there's certainly no good in trying to understand what the actual model is. Okay, so for topology, they're not so good. And in particular, also snapshot data don't give you, kind of identify your parameters. And the route we sort of fortuitously have been able to choose is because of Dirk Busch's technique to develop single cell based adoptive transfer experiments. If you can do this on a single cell level and you know the statistics of these pedigrees, which I will call single cell progenies. And mind you, it's not necessary to know them continuously, which you don't in vivo, but only through a snapshot measurement, say beginning is one cell and the end is whatever, some statistics. This is much more informative. And so that's the underlying idea. And before I developed this some time ago. And just to recap, two slides to recap what we already did, and then I'll talk about newer work. So the idea is you do these adoptive transfers by transferring individual single cells, say naive cells, and then we identify these types of phenotypes. Again, you see here, this is a very large progeny of an individual cell, CD27, CD62L. It would appear as if the differentiation process judged by these two markers would be rather a continuous process. And nevertheless, traditionally, we distinguish these cell types by putting gates into this figure here, okay? And I think it's a good instrument to analyze the data, but we should keep in mind maybe it's also a little artificial. Maybe it's more a continuum than individual cell types. And these are examples of progenies in a very strong immune response to Listeria. These are OT1 cells. Listeria carries an OVA protein that then also presents the cognate peptide for the OT1 T cell receptor, or leads to presentation. And you see that the individual responses are very different. They're very large progenies, moderate size, very small progenies, and so on. However, most progenies make at least two cell types, according to this, or all three of them. So in principle, a single naive cell can make all of these here, okay? There is some nomenclature in the literature. People fight about markers and use different markers. I will not get into this, but there's also a term that I really quite like. These cells are, during the acute response, would be called memory precursor effector cells, which means we think they're precursors of memory, but they also show effector properties. And in particular, this cell type here, I would think, is the real one. For these, sometimes people also call this like, and these are really short-lived effector cells. Really, as I said, you will see this in the data, I would really make the division here. I mean, this is the real division line for me. So this is showing that the single-cell properties of single-cell progenies, of course, have some statistical properties here. This is just sort of plotting one against the other and all the sort of pairwise combinations. And for example, you get a feeling that, I mean, this is the correlation between effector cells and effector memory cells, very highly correlated. During the acute response, that's day 7, day 8, either day 8 or day 10 after Listeria, it's a very vigorous response. While, for example, central memory precursors and effector cells are practically not correlated, okay? And it's these features that we try to exploit in the analysis, not just the mean value numbers. And to do this, of course, we have to keep track of what we think about the heterogeneity in the system. And it's quite clear, I think, that there will be some contribution in the sense that the individual progenitor cells may have heterogeneous phenotypes already. So there's maybe some heterogeneity from the outset. But there's also, when you go through your proliferation, expansion, and differentiation steps, a lot of variability in the timing of these events, okay? And we assume, of course, there will be both of these things will be present. In our modeling, we just focus on this part and assume that this part here is negligible. And I think this is open to criticism. I want to be completely open about that, okay? There's two reasons why we think this part has a strong role to play. And the first is, and this really comes from very extensive work by several people, I think Phil Hodgkin, and in collaboration with Ken, has really driven this field. And this is looking at these kind of pedigrees in vitro. And what we see there is that there are interesting longitudinal properties that are propagated from a naive cell once it's been stimulated. But the timing of proliferation events is not one of them. So proliferation correlations in proliferation timing of cell cycle events decay actually in the longitudinal direction relatively rapidly over just a few generations. So it's not that we have fast and slow proliferating naive cells, at least that's what it looks like. And the second evidence, we've recently been able to compare some of our own in vitro data, which is really preliminary work, and we're also thinking about looking at the other already existing data here, compare them with the variability we see in vivo. And the variability we see in these in vivo data is much larger than the variability we see in these in vitro data, which actually suggests that in vivo, the sampling of a heterogeneous environment may play an overriding role in timing these decisions. Okay. So what we do is we just focus on this aspect. We make relatively simple models that just contain stochastic differentiation proliferation steps. We consider naive cells as identical. It's very important that the experiment really understands the initial conditions precisely, otherwise we cannot interpret the data. So we think actually limiting dilution is not quite good enough, perhaps. We haven't really worked with this kind of data, but sorting naive cells, single naive cells, definitely is. And in contrast to some of this work, which I can only stress and stress again, I mean, is massively insightful for us, we try to stay with very few parameters. So the models you'll see are very, very simple because we want to identify these parameters from the data. Okay, so we want to have as little leeway as possible. And in particular, an assumption that we made initially and that we're now slowly giving up is that we say these rates are constant during the entire process. So then the framework would be like this. We have individual events, differentiation, proliferation. They can characterize either by rate or we can assume more complex distributions of these transition times. We did both. I will show mainly these kind of data here. We find that at the level of resolution of the data, it makes very little difference whether we apply a framework like this or a framework like that. Although I have to say, of course, this is a lot more realistic because, I mean, zero waiting times for proliferation is quite unrealistic, I should say that. We also looked at cell death. We will not talk about this today. We have a pathway topology of how these individual cell types are linked. This is our favorite one here. Where all of these steps have their own rate constants, and that leads to a kind of a scheme where we write down some kind of Markov process, look at simple ways of reducing the computational complexity of it so that we can actually fit a lot of models. So we do this just by looking at the first and second moments for which we can write ordinary differential equations and then fit to the first and second moments. The data we use are mean value data that are measured in the time resolution and snapshot data for the both for the mean values and second moments of these kind of single progeny distributions. And I should say there's at least two approaches I know of that look at things in a related way that also try to exploit the information that is contained in a single cell progeny data that is larger than information that's just in the mean values. And that's a very nice work by Ken and Leila on hematopoiesis. And also Roland Regers, who unfortunately isn't here, has some interesting work on Salmonella dynamics in the body. But so I think there's some related ideas around here.
Sorry,
yeah. Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Exactly. This is our three cell types. I just want to be concrete. Look at this as our central memory precursor, effector memory precursor, effector cells.
Sorry, EF is what again?
Effector. EF is for effector. Yeah. Sometimes called SLEC, short-lived effector cells, SLEC. This is largely what is our TEF is. If you go into the details, people use slightly different sets of markers. Okay.
They're sort of also equivalent to what people call exhausted sometimes, right?
This is an interesting area, I would say. So how exhausted cells come into this whole thing, I think, is something that's open.
Right. But that fourth quadrant often is PD-1 positive and CD28.
You mean this one here?
Yeah.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Which is sort of.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if exhaust is the right word, but it's what people call it.
Right.
The tricky point with PD-1 is that PD-1 goes up any time a cell sees antigen through the T cell receptor.
Right.
And so what people call exhausted is because they've waited a certain period of time and, you know, it's not chronic, and then they're probably exhausted.
There is this interesting work by Dietmar Zehn, I don't know what you think of it, where they actually show that you can reactivate exhausted cells. So they contain some cells that are capable of quite large re-expansion.
It's a mixed population. Yeah.
So I don't know how exhausted cells are overlaid on this. We only look at the really acute response. That's pretty much it. Okay, here we are. So why would this method work? Just a simple illustration. We try to do more work of this. You can think about mean value kinetics are definitely informative if you know your scheme. But if you don't know your scheme and you want to distinguish, for example, between a linear pathway and a branch pathway, you can have practically indistinguishable mean value kinetics if you just get the parameters right. And this is clear because mean value kinetics just give you a temporal sequence. And you can produce the temporal sequence in the same way, irrespective of whether you have a branch point or not. It's just showing that C is slower than and it can be because there's an intermediate step here. but it also can be because this step is intrinsically slow itself, okay? If you look at single cell progenies, you start to see that maybe the single cell progenies are informative. So for example, here you see a lot of correlation between B and C, while here this correlation is absent, essentially absent. And it's these kind of features, and I have to say the approach is a little bit non-intuitive because we really rely on all the second moments collectively, and we cannot really say which one is the most important one in a particular situation. So it's really very computational what we can do.
The three columns with the three different parameters, what are they?
This one here?
No, the row 0.25, 0.1, 0.25.
This is correlation coefficients, sorry.
Oh, I see.
So the pairwise correlation coefficients, just sort of, and this is just simulated data. So it's just should show the principle that while the mean values are indistinguishable, we start to find differences in the higher moments.
And these correlations are taken at one given time?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. At one given time. And we've so far only worked with snapshot measurements, and they turn out to be really very informative. I showed this on the...
So each point in these things is one experiment?
So each one would be one single cell progeny, and...
One single cell.
The progeny of one single cell that reaches these kind of cell numbers. And the experiment, to some extent, is multiplexed because we put several single cells into a mouse, but we also average, we also take several mice to generate a data set of about 100 of these progenies, which in practical terms seems to be the size of the data you need to get anything reasonable. Okay?
And so you take snapshots because you...
You have to kill the mouse. That's the snapshot. The mean value dynamics, we kill a lot of mice. The point is, the single cell measurement in itself is more time consuming. So, and plus, at early time points, the single cells are difficult to measure.
No, because then you can say you also have the single cell progeny the whole time.
Yeah, so we do, to some extent, so what we sometimes, so at least for the data I will show, we have it at two time points, okay? And it keeps, and that needs to be kept in mind that single, the means are more reliable at slower cell numbers than these statistical properties. So when the progenies are not large, so this is it's not subset size in total, but subset size in percent. So the whole thing is growing exponentially, and this is the portion of the subsets that you typically measure. And at low times, the subsets are small themselves, so this measurement is practically not really feasible.
So in this simulation, you actually simulated the rate model that you have?
Yeah, this is just exponential, I think.
And so you get such a wide range of...
Different cell numbers. Yeah, I think because it's growing the whole thing, so it's exponential. It's not going into a steady state. Okay, so we look at the acute immune response, so it's still an exponential growth.
Small differences get amplified.
Yeah, small differences in initial timing get amplified quite a lot. For reasons of time, I skip over this. So this is not a foolproof method using the second moments. It works in certain areas of parameter space where it actually works dramatically, but it doesn't work for all parameters. So we're actually finding difficulties doing the same thing for CD4 cells because I think we're not in a favorable region of parameter space. And one thing, as a rule of thumb, it works well if you have a proliferative hierarchy that you get slowly proliferating cells giving rise to rapidly proliferating cells, just as a... I mean, but there's more to it. Okay, so this is published. We use this sort of scheme where we start, just to briefly recap, from a naive cell that has all three differentiation possibilities, and then we allow for all other differentiation pathways. We allow for selective proliferation. So and then we consider all possible submodels of this, including the complete model. It's about 300 of them. We compare them with the single cell data here I've shown for this Listeria immune response down here. And there's a surprising hierarchy in terms of how well the models perform. We use different criteria, but the hierarchy is always the same. There's two models that fit the data very well, and the other 200, 302 don't fit them well enough. So there's a big step here. And these two models turn out to be the models that have this sequence that I've shown before. So that was the first hint that there is this kind of sequence. These cells give rise to these other types of cells. Okay. Here's an example of the mean value kinetics, which at the time when we did it was actually a prediction. So we just had the single cell progenies. We actually predicted the mean value kinetics from the single cell progenies, and they were spot on. I would like to point out one more thing is here, that there's great in vitro work. And this in vitro work And there's been a recent paper from Phil, or where Phil has been on Nature Communications, and there's other papers where people seem to see in vitro that the cells don't have this central memory precursor phenotype for some time, and then suddenly they turn up later in the in vitro response after a few cell divisions. We don't seem to see this in the in vivo data, although there's 62L shedding and many things that the aficionados will know about. We don't see that CD62L is sort of going away and coming back again, but it's continuously present in the immune response, and it gets increasingly dwarfed by the developing effector response.
So the memory response comes first?
The what I don't know at which point you came. Maybe I should come.
Okay, well,
I show you the summary, and then you know it all. So okay. What we think is all the cells are effector cells during the acute immune response, but they can already be distinguished according to their potential of what they can generate later. And we think there's a proportion of these cells that are really central memory precursors that work more or less like a stem cell that become central memory cells that can re-expand fast. And form new immune responses. Okay, and just about to see. And this for us. I mean, this model has been around before, but this was for us the first glimpse that maybe that this model is at least compatible with the data. None of the other models. I should put out all these models here do not involve this transition that naive cells give right straight away to this. They're actually the worst models of the whole bunch. I mean, all of these models are pretty bad, but they're the worst of the bad.
Thomas. Just to add to that, Michal Polonsky in Nir's lab has looked quite carefully at CD62L in vitro, and what she sees is a very rapid fall as you activate, but within a day they're back. So in your time frame, you would not see that.
Exactly. So I'm not saying it's not shattered or it's not going down, but we don't need to wait long to see it again.
Right.
So the only point I want to make is, I think both approaches are useful, and it's interesting to see that Michal is seeing this because other people don't see that apparently in vitro. I'm pleased to see that. But it's really interesting. The point is interesting of what kind of environment you create in vivo. I'm sure there is an inbuilt program that you can see in vitro, but there's also signaling events that you cannot reconstitute in vitro. So, but it's interesting information. I wasn't aware of that. I talked with Michal when I was there. Which would actually fit this idea, so the initial job we wouldn't see. Okay, the only point I want to point out here before let me go on for another 5 to 10 minutes, if that's okay, it's about 10 now, is these models are identifiable. So we have relatively sparse measurements only at one time point of these higher moments, but the parameters now become identifiable. And we can do simulations and compare them with the data and so on, so it all looks pretty good. So first of all, I show you a little bit of evidence, and I can go very quickly and just give the main messages before I come to the second part. It's looking at this proliferation business. I think for us it's the most interesting new part. There's published work by Dirk that has been stimulated by these findings, and they did a stem cell type experiment where they isolated specific naive T cells. So again, this is all OT1 based, put them into mouse, asked whether they can regenerate all the cell types down here. Indeed, they can, of course, not the naive cells themselves. Then you take, so this is immune response from naive cells, then you take central memory cells out, put a single memory cell, central memory cell into a mouse that generates a full-blown clonal response. You get central memory cells out from this response, get it in the second mouse, again generates a full-blown response. So this is first of all showing that the central memory cells are multipotent here, and the second transfer is showing that they're actually self-renewing. There's not a lot of them generated during acute response to sustain further responses. And there's a nice review coming up this year, sorry.
Is that with or without the presence of antigen?
This is generated by an acute infection. It's a wild-type mouse, so it has all other strains. This is put in and again infected, put in, infected. So it's always in the presence of antigen. We also find that it's quite in keeping with this linear scheme that we proposed here, is that occasionally, if this scheme is true, you should accidentally use your central memory stage if you differentiate out too fast at the single progeny level. And we find evidence of what is known as a neutral drift in this system. And moreover, the data agree quite well with the prediction of the simple model. So we found about 20% of the primary single cell progenies that do not have memory potential. Okay, And I think this is also, if I don't remember the data correctly, consistent with work from John Schumacher's lab, where also Rob has been involved. This is speaking strongly against the idea that asymmetric cell divisions, which you see under the microscope, really are the main determinant of asymmetric cell fates later on. Okay, and we elaborated on this a little bit more. Okay, what we mean is that so you start off, say, with a naive cell, and then your naive cell gives rise to other cell types, and you ask the question whether at some point you actually sort of lose sort of, it's a bit Grant talked about last week. So we would get a simplification of the, if you viewed the single cell progenies as individual clones, you would simply get a simplification or reduction of clonal number, because by accident some clones are lost, they have lost their stem cells. That's what we mean, but it's not through due to competition, it's a simple mutual phenomenon. Would that be an acceptable use of the term, I think. And I think if and you can really make the models if most of the differentiation events would be based actually on an asymmetric division of resources, you would see this far more infrequently. Actually, would not probably not detect it. And I think as we try to make some more sophisticated analysis here, where we don't put this argument in, but it's in the it's actually here in the immunity paper. Okay. Good. Let me just. Okay.
So you don't need to use death for that.
It just sort of differentiates out.
It differentiates faster than renews.
Yeah. And I think death is, for these cells, I would assume is not a major issue, although that hasn't been studied so well, I should say. We see that death, I mean, there's Philip Busso's work with the caspase sensor. I mean, death comes on relatively early already during the primary response. We already see caspase activation starting from day 3 and so on. So I think death is a bit an unknown factor of all of this. Okay. Okay, let me just sort of show two results that we found quite striking. The first of all is we can now do, after we know this sort of self-renewing property and multipotent property, we can ask what do the recoil responses look like quantitatively? The primary responses are carried by a naive cell, recoil responses are carried by a central memory cell. And what we find is, this is again done with the same method, with the single cell progeny method. What we find is they're not distinguished at the single cell level. So the single cell, single central memory cell, gives rise to the same kind of progeny as a naive cell gives. So why are memory responses more rapid? I think there are many reasons for this, but in terms of this framework here, is probably the number of precursors is the main distinguishing feature. The individual cell is in no way faster than what the naive cell is doing. That's a bit surprising, I would say. Okay.
Just rates. Do you count the number of divisions that they potential that they have?
We don't count the number of divisions, but we have an idea of the absolute cell numbers because we gobble up the spleen, not the whole mouse. Yeah. And now you have to divide the divisions into these sort of sources, so it's not entirely unique. So it's a real inference, but the inference is good from the data. So the confidence bounds are small. So it's a real inference. You see that here. Okay.
Thomas, do you look at the time from when you stimulate the cell till it starts division? Because that's also been reported to be different, so that memory cells will go into the division cycle faster than a naive cell because they basically have got the machinery.
Yeah. We would love to do that. I have to say that. I can only say what we see. So I also think that what the other people describe is valid. However, what we see is that the diversity of single cell progenies in the memory response is just as large as the diversity of single cell progeny sizes in the primary response. And I think if the first step would be a lot more synchronized, you would expect that the diversity would go down because the initial steps are very important for generating diversity. So that's what I can say. Okay, so and here you see for the first time really the inference of the proliferation rates that in the last, okay, if you give me 2-3 minutes, I don't know when is the next talk starting, can I have? Okay, good. Very
so good. How do you measure proliferation rates?
I'll show you BRDU data in a second. Okay. That's the new thing. So but we've been struggling quite a bit with this. So this is a computational inference. It's not a measurement. Okay. So we want to see how fair this is. I'll show you just one more thing for the immunologists. Is we used a different pathogen. This is a bacterium, intracellular bacterium. We used a virus. And in terms of their cytokine environment, they should be quite different, actually, okay, in terms of the type of inflammation. Nevertheless, we find, again, also for the virus, we find a very similar pattern of rates. And the only reason that I could think of is that the overriding, that the overriding feature of the whole thing is the OT1 T-cell receptor. It's a very strong T-cell receptor. It sees its cognate antigen, and it doesn't seem to care very much about the rest of it. At least, let's put this up, it's a bit provocative. I can see that, but these are the data. You can form your own opinion. Okay, so I think we talked a little about this. Antigen stimulus could be decisive. So let's look at this hierarchy in proliferation rates and a bit at the antigen stimulus. So I'll be quick.
Thomas?
Yeah?
Can we go for a second to the slide with the model and the goodness of feet?
Here, for example, or here?
Yeah. So the model here is just different set of parameters, or it's a different wiring diagram?
So each model is characterized by these parameters, so that would have six. But we generate systematically all models that give rise to all three cell types, which is some graph theoretical enumeration of all the models that we parameterize and put against the data. And this is the count. And the reason why we don't have 306 models here is that upon fitting, a lot of best fits have parameters being zero, so models actually collapse into one another.
When there's a couple of models which fit, has low AIC.
These ones?
That means a wiring and a set of parameters.
Exactly. And we think we can discriminate quite well, and I come to your question, is because the fitting the parameters is well defined in a statistical sense. Otherwise, we could not say anything about a wiring, I would say.
I don't have much experience with fitting a lot of parameters. Because a physicist, I'm always very, very suspicious about it.
Yeah, sure.
No offense, man. So is it suspicious in any way that you get just two very fine-tuned set of parameters that only can describe the data, or it's fine?
We have to be careful. There is a numerical step involved here, which is the optimization. And we try to be as careful as we could about the optimization, that we sort of scan this parameter landscape sufficiently to be sure that if you have a non-fitting model, we are not stuck somewhere in an unfavorable part. And the other thing is here, the maximum that we find is quite unique. And the parameter space is not so high dimensional given compared to other models. It's 6, 7, 8 dimensional is quite something, but it's not 20.
So is there a way to somehow, independently verify any of those good fit models without statistics? So let's say take some very clear-cut prediction of those or something like
that. So this was the first prediction that we made, and it's a real prediction. We predicted this, and these are the data. Okay. I'll show you a second prediction now.
Okay.
Sure.
I'm trying to speak.
Yeah.
your model depends on a constant antigen presence. My understanding is as antigen goes down, because of the effectors, that the dynamics will change.
Absolutely.
You get more production of memory cells rather than effector cells.
Let me come to this point. Maybe I use 5 minutes and then we can discuss it, because we have a very, very different view on this. And I will try to explain why other people come to a different conclusion. So maybe what you say is phenotypically correct, but there's also papers around who say that if you give a weak antigen, you tend to get more memory cells, and if you give a strong antigen, you tend to get more effector cells. My understanding of the papers that I've read is that they're not correct, for the very reason, I'm being blunt, maybe you'd have contributed, and then we can discuss even better. The papers that I looked at look at frequencies of these cells. They don't count the numbers of the cells. And it's trivial that with a weak antigen that initiates this process, you're being stuck at this part if your antigen is weak, and you don't get very much to this part, okay? But the total number of cells is dismal. compared to strong antigen, where you produce much more effector cells, so the memory response looks proportionally smaller, but in absolute numbers it's larger. And the papers I've seen so far by Mike Bevan and so, they have this problem. They look at cell frequencies rather than actual cell numbers. So I think the question, let's put it moderately, I think the question is out whether these papers are correct, but looking at frequencies is not the right way of looking at the question.
Sorry,
what do you lose by just fitting with first and second moments?
What do I lose?
Yeah, so you're fitting with the third and higher.
We never tried, I have to say, because fitting is a practical exercise, and we can of course do stochastic simulations and fit with stochastic simulations and fit the entire probability distribution, but it's just not practical for our point. You have to fit very, very often to do statistics and so on. So we fit the first and second moments for the only reason that, maybe I can give a better answer, that this is computational simple. We can write down ODEs for them. The point is we compare to higher moments and actually total distributions, which I can show you, also the we catch the distributions actually quite well by just fitting to the moments.
Yeah, but if it's a linear system, then you can get like a computer to do
absolutely,
the
differentiation
to get all of the
absolutely.
Moments like
some sure.
ridiculous numbers.
Absolutely sure. It's a bit a question also how well you can estimate higher moments from the data, what your confidence bounds are and so on. So we just checked whether we could get the right distributions and the distributions look fine by just fitting the moments. But of course that's not guaranteed, I would agree. Okay.
Thomas?
Yeah.
Maybe before you proceed, I think we forgot that there's a black book launch today at 12:15, and it's meant for all the participants of all the programs. So we should probably try and be out of here by 12.
Okay.
Or 5 or something, which means that since there's a second talk, maybe you should try and aim to be really finished at 10:45.
Absolutely. So, this is plenty of time. So, I'll wrap up in 5 minutes and then we have.
Including interruptions.
Exactly. I will not respond to interruptions and then have a discussion because these are simple points. So, first of all, is there a proliferative hierarchy that we would predict in the data? And of course, the method of choice is BRDU. And all what we can say, it looks like it. It's not massive, but also we don't, so this would be like from a gamma distribution model, this would be a distribution we would fit just as an example. And you see about where the division times are and so on, and how they're distributed. And so now this is a slightly different system that Veit developed in Dirk's lab. I think it's taken over from Mike Bevan, I think if I'm not mistaken, where we use antigen-loaded dendritic cells instead of using listeria that can produce the antigen itself. The reason is that we want to ablate these dendritic cells, they're toxin sensitive. So we have a tool to time at least the antigen stimulus in terms of its duration, okay? But this is where we didn't take them out. We just put BRDU at some point. This is day 6 data here. And you clearly see this is incorporated cells here. And you see quite well that the level of incorporation in a short time span is much lower in the central memory compartment here than in the effector memory precursors and the effector compartment. And you can quantify this to some extent. And the agreement is not bad, I would say. So, so BRDU is a nucleus acid analog that gets incorporated in the DNA that can be stained for in the FACS by some intracellular staining. And so you only get BRDU into the DNA if the cells are dividing. And this is called the labeling trace, so this is a labeling experiment. But the longer term timescales, I think, are often delabeling experiments or both, where you actually switch off the source of BRDU and you wait until it gets diluted. So this is the labeling phase that we look at here.
Thomas,
yep, well, sure.
Very quick question. When you say proliferation, do you mean net proliferation or proliferation?
Interesting question. I don't know. So we completely disregarded cell death at this stage, which may be a mistake, or maybe something to be looked at.
And in your literature,
but this is day 6 of the immune response, and I think cells are not dying at a massive scale at this stage.
So, and it's the same for your topology work, the lineage models.
We tried to put different death in here, and we can do it with constant death rates, and it doesn't change anything.
Sure.
Let's put it like this. Yeah. Okay.
How long was the BRDU dose?
16 hours. So it's continuous BRDU for 16 hours, and then measurement right at this point.
At that point, okay.
But the 16 hours is not a bit of a problem because you'll have cells that are actually cycling.
Yeah, we think it is. So it's a bit, the point is it's labeling, but the cells are also probably the labeling efficiency not 100%. So we also think that we already get delabeling during the actual labeling phase. At least that's what the data, it's been very hard to really get more quantitative information out than this. We don't get actual rates for many reasons. I'm happy to discuss the details. So we're not sure whether what the labeling efficiency is, and whether we already see delabeling during the labeling phase because the labeling efficiency is not 100%. Is this what you meant?
No, I'm just curious because we've been doing BRGAD things in order to get rates. What's the big difference between whether you do IVIG or whether you do...
So I think they inject it as far as I know. They try to...
So the muscle they're not because you have a pretty slow release of the BRGs. The labeling period turns out to be much longer than you think.
Yeah. I'm happy to discuss this a bit because in a real quantitative sense, I mean, the scale is right, but we have some difficulty interpreting this data. The point, the rationale for this experiment, I should just say, was that we should go to short periods and catch the labeling. But if we have too short periods, we see too few labeled cells. So it's sort of a compromise. Okay. So we also tried to simulate this in the model, see what a good labeling period was. And we came up with this time scale. I'm happy to get more input. Okay. This is good. So this is the very last set of data where we do antigen ablation prematurely. And this is now with this disease here, and we can give the real toxin to which these diseases are sensitive, which ablates them within a time scale of about, say, 12 hours. So at 60 hours, the dendritic cells are gone. Okay. And what you see is here, this is again single cell progenies in the spleen shown in a slightly different way. This is the number of cells in these progenies. This is the control experiment in open circles and the DC depletion in, and you see that DC depletion has a massive effect on cell numbers. Okay? It also has an effect on the composition of the progenies, of course. Now you can crank the whole, this point I already made, be critical of data, cell numbers is really key. You can crank everything now through this model again. We can do model, I should say that with all the data we have, we also do model discrimination again and again. And again and again, we find this linear model in the data, but it's not surprising because the data under any condition look very much like what we had before. Okay. So now we changed the model in the following way, that we said there's one model until about 60 hours with one set of proliferation rates, and then we've depleted disease, there's another model. Okay? And the way the models are different is simply by the proliferation rates. We cannot identify, we found this out, and we cannot say anything about these differentiation rates, and that's a big caveat, simply the data are not rich enough to do this, so we just left them unchanged. So I'm just reporting everything we did. But we said, okay, maybe let's see whether we can account with changes of proliferation rates for the effect. And this is what we get. So this is now, for these data here, again, we make a BRDU experiment, but now we get the antigen depletion earlier, okay? So we think we can go with our BRDU even a little bit earlier, let's see, at 4 days. And this is what we get. This would be the prediction that we get out of this red data here and the white data, and if you can compare them, then we see that the rates that are most affected here, this is always the ratio of this proliferation rate in the DC depleted case over the non-depleted case. The rate that is most affected is the central memory precursors, while the others are relatively are affected less so. Okay, so antigen depletion in our hands affects actually both, all three, but it's really the central memory that are most strongly affected. And this is the data that we have to this point. Okay. And again, this BRDU and there are caveats in the method, but nevertheless, we clearly see there's the hierarchy that we predict, and we also see that definitely central memory precursor cells are most strongly affected. We see less difference in the data on these other progenies than we actually see here, but mind you, this is really dictated by the measured cell numbers, so I'm not sure whether how much this is a question of the reliability of BRDU as a method, I should say. This has functional consequences. If you look at the recall response under the early antigen ablation situation, the recall response is heavily compromised. So we actually see that this central memory compartment that suffers the most is actually the one that's most compromised. So let me wrap up here. So proliferation in the antigen suggests the proliferation of central memory precursors is highly antigen dependent because they respond most strongly. I think I was a little bit black and white. It's still out whether the others are not also affected, but we definitely see a strong effect here. And we think also, let me go back, that this effect that we see here is actually possibly an effect of the natural depletion of the antigen that Robin mentioned. And I should say this is entirely unpublished stuff, but if you go earlier in the immune response, we see rather less difference. Okay, so it looks like that under condition of full antigen stimulation, the proliferation rates between the subtypes are rather the same, while as antigen goes down, at least that's our take on these are the cells that are most reliant on antigen, while these are the cells that may to some extent be already on autopilot. Not entirely here. Okay. I would like to make a general point that I feel quite strongly about this, and this also relates to our heterogeneity discussion last week, is we see a lot of heterogeneity, and of course we try to learn from heterogeneity, but I think there's different approaches. One is just to try to enumerate the outcomes in an intelligent way, and often that's the only thing we can do. But of course, if we find generating models that generate this heterogeneity, and in this case, I think we at least made a suggestion of a model, that can be very productive, because the models themselves, as I tried to show, can be much simpler than the actual observe phenotypic heterogeneity than in the experiment. And I should also say that now one thing that's heavily ongoing together with Dirk in the lab is actually we try to molecularly characterize some of these processes. Let me just end up with saying Michael is really to thank for a lot of this work, and he's just about to move to Munich, actually to Dirk's Institute, to open a theoretical group there, which will have very strong interaction with the experimental work, mainly to work on chronic inflated immune responses and also anti-tumor responses. So there'll be interesting opportunities up soon. Okay, thanks very much.
Thomas, you're the role model for future speakers. So you made this point about the generative model. I guess we already see the effective functions trying to minimize, but can you with the model, with the kind of stochastic effect that you have in the model, can actually explain all the heterogeneity that you see in the data? You have more in the data than you would predict in the model.
Yeah, embarrassingly, at the level that we are at, I think we explain most of it really well by this, and which is reason for more discussion, I think, because maybe there's also heterogeneity that gets inherited from the naive cell that
is
part of the model.
Exactly. But if you start from a heterogeneity of precursor cells that each have their own rights,
right?
You know, yeah. Could you have evidence that something like this could happen as well?
So I think here the in vitro work is very informative. I don't know whether Phil is giving a talk online.
Phil won't be here.
I know.
I'm going to do a talk showing and possibly summarize the work.
Yeah, I think Kerry's going to present.
Yeah. So I think I have to refer a little bit to, I think this is the most informative work that we have. And there's interesting features that seem to be progeny specific. The only thing that we did so far, we tried to compare the variability that's seen in vitro data and the variability that we see in the in vivo data in terms of cell numbers. And there we see the variability in cell numbers in the in vivo data is a lot larger.
Yeah, we'll probably give a very serious update to the in vivo work.
Okay, good. Then we wait, when yeah, just yeah, wait for that. Yeah.
Can I ask another question about the building of the models?
Yeah.
Go back again to that slide. So what exactly goes into building the model? So all the raw site of data, or just the sort of dynamics of the phenotypes which already will somehow interpreted by experimental data?
Right. So maybe I wasn't clear here. We just use two markers. So it's a two-dimensional FACS experiment.
Okay.
That also look rather continuous to make kind of artificial divisions between these three quadrants.
Mm-hmm.
Count cell numbers in these quadrants, mm-hmm. and the models are simply population dynamic models. We're trying very hard to, at the same time pursue ideas where we look at the molecular setup and can we get developmental trajectories in the molecular setup. And we published a little piece last year, but that's really ongoing work, I would say.
Just coming back to Terry's point about naive heterogeneity. So what the main difference, if you incorporated that, would be some sort of longitudinal correlation, you mean, between...
I would say...
So at the moment, you just pick every generation, you pick again from the distribution.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I'm going to show evidence that there's damage or not. So that's where I must have heterogeneity, which is what Tom Schumacher says.
Is your data based on a transgenic model, or maybe not too long? So there's still heterogeneity of individual clones, even though they would be identical to some extent. But do you think if you didn't have, I mean, would the heterogeneity at the receptor level actually swamp out all of these subsequent heterogeneities?
No, I don't think so. Even in what looks like a very homogeneous system, you get very interesting findings.
We also, Michal Zbarovsky also gets a lot of using OT2s in vitro, this is in vitro in single cell experiments, and an enormous amount of heterogeneity from what appears to be as homogeneous as you can tell.
In both your studies, are you on the RAG background?
Yeah, we are.
You're not, then the other receptors is there and will modify.
Yeah. We tried to explain it on the basis of CDR3 expression, for example, trying to sort high and low it, but it only explains a small proportion of the error. Something else is heterogeneous inside the cell somehow.
So it's really this point here. So we look forward to Ken's talk about that.
Yeah. The problem is that I'm going to give phenomenology and then we're going to give a very brief description of Phil's work, which is actually the mechanism. But that's Phil's work.
Okay, so why don't we stop here?